The film The King's Speech is nominated for 12 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for the performance of Colin Firth. He plays King George VI of England, who came to the throne in 1936 and suffered from an embarrassing stutter. His efforts to overcome the impediment with the help of an innovative speech therapist is at the center of the film, which is directed by my guest, Tom Hooper. The film was written by David Seidler, who suffered from a stammer himself and took heart as a child listening to King George's radio addresses. Seidler became a successful screenwriter and dreamed of writing about the king. Eventually, he tracked down the handwritten diary of the king's speech therapist, Lionel Logue. Much of the scenes between King George and Logue are based on this diary. Director Tom Hooper won an Emmy for his work on the HBO miniseries Elizabeth I, starring Helen Mirren. He also directed the miniseries John Adams. Among his other films are Longford and The Damned United. I spoke with him in November. Well, Tom Hooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
This film, The King's Speech, this is one of these films where we don't have to worry about giving away the story. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. It's about this very close relationship between the king, George VI, and his unorthodox speech therapist. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. The king is played by Colin Firth, and the speech therapist, Lionel Logue, is played by Jeffrey Rush. And this is a moment where they've been working together for some period of time. George VI is now about to be crowned king, and this is a moment where they have cleared out Westminster Abbey so that they can rehearse and this king can confront the task of making a few remarks upon the occasion of his coronation. And they get into an argument, and I'll just mention it makes it easier for the clip if we note that there's a point at which the therapist, Logue, has the effrontery to park his seat in the chair where monarchs sit, and we'll hear that. And what really begins the argument is the king is frustrated and fearful and angry about this situation, and he also has discovered that Lionel Logue is not a doctor and is essentially self-taught. Let's listen.
No training, no diploma, no qualifications, just a great deal of nerve.
Lock me in the tower.
I would, if I could.
On what charge?
Fraud. With war looming, you've saddled this nation with a voiceless king. You've destroyed the happiness of my family, all for the sake of ensnaring a star patient you couldn't possibly hope to assist. It'll be like mad King George III. It'll be mad King George the Stammerer, who let his people down so badly in their hour of need. What are you doing? Get up! You can't sit there! Get up!
Why not? It's a chair.
No, that is not a chair. That is St. Edward's chair.
People have carved their names on it.
Chair is the seat on which every king in your life...
I don't care how many royal arseholes have sat.
Listen to me!
Chair.
Listen to me!
Listen to you by what right?
By divine right, if you must. I'm your king.
No, you're not. You told me so yourself. You said you didn't want it. Why should I waste my time listening to
because
you?
I have a right to be, and I have a voice!
Yes, you do.
And that's Jeffrey Rush and Colin Firth from The King's Speech, directed by our guest, Tom Hooper. You could hear Colin Firth and his playing a royal with a stutter. He has to get this just right. He can't overdo it. Tell us about developing his character.
I think the inspiration for his performance for both of us was the real king. And we found this wonderful bit of archive footage on the Pathé news site, which I think is available on their public site. From the
one in Glasgow,
Empire Exhibition, 1938. And, you know, try as the newsreel people can to cut away from Bertie. So they cut from his close-up to, you know, spectators in the crowd. They cut to fluttering flags. They cut to chimney pots rather randomly. Whenever they come back in this profile close-up to the king, you can see in his eyes this longing. He just wants to get it right. That's all he wants to achieve. And he keeps getting caught in these horrible, painful silences in which he drowns, and he stops himself and gathers himself and tries again and gets caught and drowns in the silence. And it's so moving that by the end of this 3 or 4 minute clip, I had tears in my eyes. And Conan and I saw this and were both hugely moved. And I'm not sure how aware Conan is, but I think he's kind of in an extraordinary way bottled the essence of the real king's stammer.
King George VI, of course, led his nation during World War II and was an important inspirational figure for his people and had to give all these speeches on the radio. And it's interesting that he was confronted with this challenge of conquering his stutter in some respects because of technology, right? I mean, 30 years before or after, he wouldn't have had such an issue, would he?
No, I mean, what's extraordinary about the whole drama of this story derives from the advent of this new medium, this new mass communication medium called radio. Because before the advent of radio, a king was a visual icon. I mean, as long as he could wave from a carriage, look good on a horse, look good in uniform, he could perform the theatrical duty of being a king, which was principally, I would say, in terms of mass iconography, visual. And with the coming of radio, suddenly a king was required to speak, to connect, and therefore to be effectively an actor. So you have this guy, you know, who's the younger brother who has no expectation of being king. You know, his older brother gives up the throne to marry the American Wallace Simpson. He has a terrible stammer and becomes king right at the moment when this medium has taken off. And, you know, his audience is not just in England. You know, Britain still has 58 countries in the empire, so it's a vast, you know, emergent global audience. You know, and he can't speak. And even more ironically, it's that, you know, 10, 15-year window when it was only a live medium. I mean, you could not pre-record, you could not edit, so you couldn't cheat the stammers out. He had to be a live performance.
When he gave these wartime speeches, was this speech therapist Lionel Logue in the room with him? Was the only one, he the only one in the room?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we can tell from the diaries, is that, you know, Lionel Logue was in the room one-on-one with the king for I think pretty much all the you know, the wartime speeches. And, you know, one of the other great thing about the diaries is it reveals what lies behind, you know, famous imagery. So, for example, it was my birthday recently, and my sister gave me a copy of The Times from the 4th of September 1939, so the day after war's been declared. Now, it being England, and we're a understated nation, news of the outbreak of the Second World War made page 8. Of the Times. And on page 8, there's a big half-page picture of King George VI in his full naval uniform at this grand ornate desk with these ornate microphones his father used in a very grand and gilt room, giving the speech that we see at the end of our movie, which is basically the speech he made when war was declared. But we know from the diaries that this is not true. He made it in a special room that Logue set up, which he decorated to make it look cheerful, with an old school desk that Logue had rescued from the basement of Buckingham Palace, you know, which he'd hammered wooden stilts on to raise it up, and the king did it standing up with his jacket off, with the window open, with Logue in the room, one-on-one. And, you know, I now know that that image, that famous image of him giving the speech, is complete nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's a piece of propaganda. And that's what I, you know, what's so lovely about the diaries is not only did it give us some flavour of their dialogue and their relationship, but it also, you know, gave me these wonderful physical clues with which to get behind, you know, the surface of the monarch at that time.
So the world knew that King George VI struggled with the speech impediment, but knew that he had managed to overcome that and give these speeches. And what this story really tells us now, it sort of unmasks this close collaborator, this man Lionel Logue, the speech therapist. Tell us just a little bit about him.
Well, he was older than the king, and he was kind of someone, you know, who grew up, you know, basically being fascinated by the voice. So he was born in Adelaide, but moved early in his life to Perth, where he married.
He's Australian.
He's Australian, yeah. In Perth, he taught elocution in schools. He recited Shakespeare and Dickens. He acted a little bit. I think he taught drama. And when the First World War came, there was this sudden influx of young men returning from the Western Front with speech problems, with post-traumatic stress disorder, with shell shock. And they literally kind of said, Lionel, you're the local guy who knows about speech, so why don't you have a crack at helping these poor young men? And that's what he did. And he basically taught himself through trial and error speech therapy in Perth and developed techniques in order to help these men. And, you know, our film suggests that what he felt was these young men, you know, had lost faith in their voice, and he was giving them the right to be heard again, you know, to talk about their trauma and to find their voice again. And he went to England, I think it was 1923 or 24, and he went because, I think on the encouragement of his wife, because he felt that, you know, London was probably where it was at in terms of speech therapy, and so, you know, he should go and find out more about it. And I think they went not intending to live there, but they ended up staying, and he ended up setting up a practice in Harley Street and landing the biggest client of his life.
Right, and of course it's actually King George's wife, who's played in the film by Helena Bonham Carter, who comes and visits Lionel Logue. One of the things that you see in his methods is that he believes it's not a matter simply of mechanics, that there is a psychological basis for this, and he invades the king's royal privacy by asking questions about what happened to him in his childhood. What do we know about the origins of King George's stutter?
What we know is that he had a very tough childhood. I mean, his parents were very absent. I mean, it's worth pointing out that children of that class, you know, aristocratic children, the norm was you would be brought down at tea time every day and prayed in front of your parents for half an hour, and that was kind of the relationship as a very young kid. You're basically your mother by nannies. But the nanny, you know, who he had very early on in life, was absolutely in love with David, his older brother, and didn't like him. I mean, not only didn't like him, but neglected him, and, you know, didn't feed him enough, and caused him, you know, stomach problems, which led to, you know, him having ulcers and being invalided out of the army during the First World War. So, I mean, what I know about stammering, and a lot of this comes from David, the writer, who had this stammer, was that when, as a young child, you lose the confidence that anyone wants to listen to you. You know, so you've got parents who aren't interested, and you've got a nanny who loves your older brother and isn't interested. You lose confidence in your voice, and you lose confidence in the right to speak. And a lot of the therapy is about saying you have a right to be heard, and people should bloody well listen.
Tom Hooper directed the film The King's Speech, which is nominated for 12 Academy Awards. Liam Neeson stars in the new thriller Unknown as a man whose identity essentially vanishes into thin air after he's injured in a car crash. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Liam Neeson has his share of triumphs as a serious actor, but after the 2008 thriller Taken was a worldwide smash, every studio wanted to see him with a gun or knife or any available lethal shard, taking out hordes of scummy thugs. You know Schindler's List? Now meet Schindler's Fist. It's easy to see why he's so compelling in thrillers. He's tall and lean, and still at 58, unbelievably handsome, but with a haggard intensity, a quality of emotional helplessness, even at his most physically resourceful. In Taken, his motivation was to get his kidnapped daughter back, and that's what he did, in a clean, straight line, obliterating anyone in his way without a wasted motion. An action filmmaker needs only to put him on screen, establish the premise, and let her rip. We're with him from the first shot of Unknown, as he stares soulfully at puffy clouds through an airplane window. He and that sleek blonde January Jones are Dr. Martin and Elizabeth Harris, and they're heading to Berlin for a big deal biotech conference. But when they arrive at their Tony Hotel, he discovers the cab driver left one of his bags at the airport and leaps into another taxi, this one driven by dishy German actress Diane Kruger, here playing a Slavic immigrant, and Martin tells her to step on it, and she takes a bad turn, and there's a bridge and a river. And 4 days later, Martin awakes in a hospital with no ID and finds that no one has been looking for him. After signing himself out against his doctor's wishes, he talks security into letting him into the conference's gala ball to find his wife.
Excuse me, madam. Your husband is here.
Liz. Oh, Jesus.
Excuse me. Do I know you?
What's wrong? I'm sorry. I was in an accident. I was in a coma. They didn't know who I was.
Well, you must have me confused with someone else.
Liz. It's me, Martin. Your husband.
This is a misunderstanding. I don't know this man. This is my husband.
You are Dr. Martin Harris?
Last time I looked. Yep, still me.
What's going on here? Is this some kind of a joke?
You know this man?
No.
Who the hell are you?
Who the hell are you?
I'm her husband.
That was Aidan Quinn looking smarmy as the so-called real Dr. Martin Harris. January Jones, meanwhile, is always so blank, it's hard to tell what's going on in Liz's head. And here's where any discussion of unknown is tricky. Is this an amnesia story, which means this guy only thinks he's Martin, despite what we saw in the early scenes? Is it a brain drain sci-fi, like Total Recall, or a virtual reality mindbender, like Inception? Is he dreaming? Is he dead but doesn't know it? Is that really his wife or a lookalike? Has he been set up by conspirators? Was the taxi driver who's disappeared in on it? Does any of this have to do with the biotechnology conference and its sponsor, a prince from some unnamed Middle Eastern country? Unknowns, unknowns. Pretty soon I got the sense that Unknown's makers were boxing themselves into a corner, and any resolution would be a giant letdown. Well, there is a letdown, but not a giant one. Certainly not enough to keep Unknown from being a hell of a great ride. The Spanish director, Jaume Collet Serra, keeps the movie lean and fast and endlessly upending. And unlike most modern crash-and-bash action directors, he stages fisticuffs and car chases you can actually follow. They're full of neat, spatial gags, like the shot in which two cars, one pursued, one pursuing, make a high-speed hairpin turn in perfect synchronization, or the Hitchcockian cat-and-mouse prowl through an art gallery amid giant photos of old women's faces. Unknown also has two marvelous turns by old pros. Bruno Ganz is a detective whom Martin hires, an ex-East German Stasi officer who's proud of his past and his reputation as a detail man. We end up rooting for totalitarian ingenuity. Then the grave and wickedly understated Frank Langella shows up as a colleague of Martin's from America to sort out the mess and make a lot more. My only quibble? Neeson takes too long to stop running away from people who want to kill him and start wasting them. But when he rises to the occasion, it's a mighty moment. That's the part of Unknown that's a known and unbeatable quantity.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition. On the web at metlife.org. This is NPR.
Abraham Lincoln freed American slaves through the Emancipation Proclamation, but he didn't always believe slaves should be freed. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with historian Eric Foner about the evolution of Lincoln's ideas.
If there's one element of greatness in Lincoln, it's this willingness to change, not being wedded to a policy once it is proven to have failed.
Join us.